Welcome to the podcast of Hemisphere, the official journal of the European Hematology Association. Hemisphere's podcast presents insightful, expert discussions about recent hematology publications. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles DeBock, and I'm your host. A brand new guidelines paper on treating neutropenias has just been published in Hemisphere. In this podcast, I am joined by two of its lead authors, Dr. Francesca Fioretta and Dr. Eleni Papadaki, on how they reached consensus expert opinion, especially when evidence in the literature was lacking for the treatment of neutropenias. So stay tuned to hear more about some of the key findings and challenges for the future, including how gene therapy might eventually play a curative role in the treatment of neutropenia. And remember, you can always catch more insightful discussions about new papers and emerging topics by following and subscribing to the Hemisphere podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the Hemisphere podcast. My name is Charles DeBock and I'm your host. Guideline papers act as a bridge between research and practice, making sure that patients benefit from the scientific advances as quickly and as safely as possible. They also provide expert consensus when evidence-based medicine is sometimes limited. And so I'm delighted today to be joined by Dr. Francesca Fioretta from the Unit of Hematology IRCCS Istituto Giannina Gaslini in Genoa, Italy, and Dr. Eleni Papadaki from the Department of Hematology, the University Hospital of Heraklion, Crete in Greece, to discuss their latest guidelines paper. Actually, it's a follow-up guidelines paper from their first one, published in Hemisphere, and this is entitled The European Guidelines on the Treatment and Supportive Measures in Chronic Neutropenia. And this was a consensus between the European Hematology Association and the UNET Inocron Cost Action based on a systematic evidence review. So I'd like to welcome to you both, although, of course, this is the second time you're appearing on the Hemisphere podcast. So welcome. I'll start with my first question. This is, of course, your second guidelines paper, which you both helped to write with the first 2 years ago, and you discussed on this very podcast. And so perhaps I can start with a very broad question. Why are these guideline articles so important when it comes to clinical practice in Europe in general, and perhaps more with respect to neutropenias?
Well, we think that these guidelines are important because actually this is the first time that we have international guidelines. Given that neutropenia is a spectrum of diseases and concerned persons that are seen not only by hematologists, but also by pediatricians, by general practitioners, etc. We think that they are important because we have produced a consensus and for the first time international guidelines that cover the treatment, but also the supportive care of these patients. So we believe that they are important because it was a very broad collaboration, and these are the guidelines that are produced for the first time in the literature.
Yes, absolutely agree with Ellen. And I think that it was a challenge to try to set up this work, but it gave us a lot of satisfaction in order to share concept, to share definition, to share way of treating patient, and to give to our patient the best treatment all over the world. The join of pediatrician and adult hematology is a very important matter. And it is not so usual to have a collaboration between the two worlds. Sometimes the hematology is very different from pediatrics to world of adults. And so I think that it is a transversal topic that deserved a lot of fatigue and efforts to reach a common view. I think this is the best success and goal we have reached together.
If I could add, Charles, if I may, although the paper mentions European guidelines, they are actually international guidelines because it was the first time that we had a broad collaboration between experts from Europe, from Israel, from the United States. So they are actually international guidelines and not only European ones.
Okay, that's excellent to know, because I actually, when I read the publication, I found the text and the concepts extremely accessible. And I love the layout with the boxes. And as you said, this is the follow-up from the first guidelines, and you said it was a lot of work. And I remember it, in the first podcast that you had with Hemisphere, you mentioned that it took over 2 years to write the first one. How did the last time when you wrote that paper, the guidelines paper, how did that inform this one in terms of your approach to write the guidelines?
Actually, this part of the guidelines took more than 3 years, because when we started to produce the guidelines, we intended to have one text that would cover both the diagnosis, the management, and the treatment of these patients. However, during the procedure, we realized that the field was naive. Because regarding the diagnosis, the management, and we had new tools, new molecular immunological tools that should be mentioned. So, and on the other hand, methodological approach should be different, because for the management, we had only the experts and the guidelines based on the experience of the experts. But for the treatment, we had some evidence from the literature. So although we started in 2021 with an intent to have one text, finally we decided to split it in the management and then in the treatment part, in order to be more helpful and more concise, and actually more helpful to the hematologists and the pediatricians and general practitioners. So it the road was long, and it took more than 2 years.
Yes. Since the beginning, we realized that the matter was too big, too huge to be described in only one paper. And moreover, we thought that having a CRAN support also in this second paper would be valuable, because the only matters that have some literature with some evidence are the topic related to therapy, while in some other fields no evidence are present. And so we try to collect also the expertise of the Cochrane in order to give some lines that are not the result of our idea or our habits or behaviors in clinical practice, but it could be also founded on major evidence from the Cochrane. The joining of Cochrane work and our work was together in the second paper. And another thing is that the strength of consensus and the calls we had to vote the consensus were very long, and so probably doing all together was impossible for diagnosis and therapy.
So if I can actually maybe focus in on that systematic review, because you describe how you went to Medline as well, and you went to the earliest records to get as much evidence as you can, and you started with 700 records and then narrowed it down only to 35, which also included only three randomized clinical trials. During that process, the fact that you had actually there wasn't that many papers as well, but were there any other surprises you found during that, you know, evidence-based literature when you went back to find the evidence for the guidelines?
Yes, the surprise was that the real evidence was too limited. There were many outdated studies and limited well-designed studies or prospective studies. And on the other hand, you know, we had case reports, we had experience from some centers which showed the real world data, because how people diagnose and treat neutropenias. However, from the methodological approach, they were not appropriate to be included. And well, it was a nice experience to read, a number of papers, but at the end, we realized that the literature was limited, outdated. And this makes more important these guidelines, and also makes important the intent to work more in the future in order to have more evidence-based guidelines.
Yes, it, the Cochrane team was a little bit astonished by the lack of evidence on this topic, and we struggled with them struggle in a certain sense, because we ask them to include also cohort studies or not case reports, but even papers with very, very low numbers of patients, because they were the only that in some case, in some fields described some news. And so really of value having reached the consensus of such a field in which evidence are low.
It's actually amazing, as you said, that given you've gone back for so far and found such a paucity of literature, highlights two things: the importance of why this guidelines paper is so timely, so you can bring together those facts and highlight the fact that more research has to be done, and highlighted the areas where that research has to occur to make sure that we can move the field forward for neutropenias. So on that, you know, what I found interesting is, you know, where you found those evidence gaps. And so you then formulated recommendations based on the collective experience of the experts involved in this. And you state that for that consensus, you needed a cutoff of 75%. And for those listeners, if you go to the paper, you'll see a box and they'll have the main headlines. And there's also a beautiful line which says, the consensus percentage being 100% down to 83% in some cases. And in fact, that's one of the take-home points that I saw, was that there was overwhelming support for the use of G-CSF in the treatment of congenital neutropenia to reduce infection and improve the quality of life. But then there was only 86% consensus when it comes to using transfusions as a therapeutic option. It would be really nice to know, like you said, it was quite an arduous process to probably align all that. And so was it actually a physical vote that you all came together to discuss? And how did people's positions change when you discuss things? Or was it quite like, here's the vote, here's the consensus, and we just report that? I guess from a reader, how do we interpret when there's, say, 86% consensus versus 100% consensus? And maybe you can shed some light on how that process occurred.
100% means that that's it. Everybody does it at the same way. So this is easy to follow. However, the percentage of, for example, in the transfusion, granulocyte transfusion, this 86% against actually the transfusion granulocytes, yes, actually reflects there are some centers or some experts that have some experience for granulocytic transfusion. And this is the remaining 14%, because, you know, granulocytic transfusion have never been actually used for chronic neutropenia patients, but have been used only for patients after transplantation or after chemotherapy. And this is an experimental approach. So when we, in this example, G-CSF is the standard of care. Everybody does it. However, the granulocytic transfusion, well, it is an approach for some centers, from some experts. So it gives a flexibility, but 100%, you know, is the rule.
Sorry, Francesca, would you like
to add anything? I think that the little difference between, for example, 75 and 100 was really, really a challenge, because inside those 25%, there was a lot of a struggle of discussion and a lot of meetings that were requested to reach at least the 75, because of the backgrounds of every of us, because of the habit, because of what we like, what we are in a habit to do in a clinical practice. So sometimes when you have not so evidence-based rules, you build in your career some attitudes that are very difficult to be changed. For example, there were a lot of discussion on cyclic neutropenia and how to treat cyclic neutropenia, that, you know, in some way you can give G-CSF once or twice a month, or otherwise a low dosage every day or every other day. So this is an example on how the discussion was done, that the result has not been reached, and we have to do another call. And it depends really on your experience and background, and that's it.
Yeah. So did you find that, because you said there was really an international consensus, that some of that disagreement or practice was geographical as well? Like, okay, in the US, we always do this, and in Europe, we always do that? Or was it even within the US, there was a lot of variation? Within Europe itself, you could say, well, actually, it's very centric to a certain, like this practice, even within Italy, they do it completely different to another practice in Italy. Was it just anecdotal?
Actually, we didn't have such difficulties because, unfortunately, we do not have many therapeutic tools until now. So the discussions were around G-CSF, corticosteroids, and granulocytic transfusions. And while we had some discussion on the formula of G-CSF, for example, the pegylated formulation of G-CSF have been given more in Italy. Francesca was the pioneer on it. However, we didn't have major differences in other aspects because we do not have many treatment approaches for these patients.
I agree with Ellen. We did not have any differences between European colleagues and American ones. Probably the most relevant difference were related to how much time you spend with patient, how much decision you have to keep, how much writing. The experience is the most important, not the geography.
Okay, that's very interesting. If I can maybe segue now to a similar concept, which was the use of corticosteroids in neutropenia, and there was a 93% consensus that this is not recommended because of the risk of infection. Again, I guess that's the same part as well. So 93%, there was probably some consensus there about the corticosteroids. Was there a reason that that wasn't 100% in this case?
You know, corticosteroids are actually contraindicated in neutropenia patients because they may result in lymphopenia. So there is some experience from some centers regarding the administration of corticosteroids in autoimmune neutropenia or chronic idiopathic neutropenia with an autoimmune basis. And again, there is no actual indication, but I assume that in the past, there were centers that did not have access to G-CSF, or they didn't have methodology to diagnose the different kind of neutropenias, and they could give corticosteroids. So it's a little space from case reports or some studies that have given corticosteroids for autoimmune neutropenias and chronic idiopathic neutropenia, but not for congenital neutropenias.
So corticosteroids is one of the most used drugs in a lot of hematological disorders. And we have learned over time what are the dangers of corticosteroids, what are the advantages. And probably the use of corticosteroids were allowed before because of lack of other alternatives in neutropenia.
One of the final points in the guidelines is the merits of stem cell transplants as a potential curative approach, and that this should be assessed at a case-by-case basis. And then what I found really interesting was that you also mentioned, you know, the future in terms of gene therapy as a way to correct mutations, in this case, either targeting to correct the ELAIN gene. How far away are we from this? And do you see this as the treatment of the future in terms of actually overcoming some of the neutropenias?
Yeah. Yes, because actually it is a fascinating field of research, because actually we do not have real treatments for this patient, real curative treatments. We have, because then, you know, G-CSF may increase the number of neutrophils. However, it does not cure these patients. And until now, the only curative option is the allogeneic stem cell transplantation, which is not for all because not everybody has a donor, and it is for a specific part of patients with high risk mutations or high risk cytogenetic abnormalities. Anyway, until now, this was the only curative option, the allogeneic stem cell transplantation. But now we have some preclinical studies based on gene editing, especially for LEN mutations, that actually correct or mute the abnormal gene. And this is the future. I don't believe that we are far from have gene therapy in the routine for these patients, because we have a very good preclinical data. We have a very strong team in Germany, Julia Skokova and her team. And I think there is space to put the mostly the regulatory framework, because, you know, this type of therapies are not widely accepted, and we need regulation, we need ethical framework as well. So we are not far, but we have to work very intensively on the regulatory framework and also to very strictly define who are these patients that will be the appropriate ones to receive such treatment, and all which will be the centers, and all these regulations as well.
Yes, the most involved person in gene therapy is our friend Julia Skokova from the German group. She and her lab has published a very interesting paper recently on molecular therapy, and they discuss a lot about the strength and the challenge of this therapy. They think that a number of steps have been done, and against, for example, some specific induced bad mutation from the gene therapy, but the promising result in some culture of the patient. So probably not so far, but some challenges as have to be faced. My thought is that, unfortunately, we will be able to correct one part of the big field of neutropenia, but at least in those person would be a possibility.
If I also could add, Charles, there is also another very interesting field, because neutropenia is not only the congenital forms where, well, gene therapy is the future. Even in autoimmune or chronic idiopathic neutropenias, which are many, more than the congenital ones, and there is also space there, because now we know more about the pathogenesis of this disorder, and we know more about, the pathways that are implicated in the pathogenesis, the inflammatory pathways, and we have started to think about a specialized and personalized treatment approach by identifying targets for this, by knowing better the pathogenesis, even for this type of neutropenias, to make plans for the future. And also the drug repurposing, and I'll give you an example, which is, it has been mentioned in our paper, the guidelines paper as well, for some congenital forms of the disease, such as the glycogen storage disease or G6PC3 mutated congenital neutropenias. We have a drug which actually inhibits the metabolism of glycose, and it has been shown it rescues them from apoptosis. So it's not only the drug, the gene therapy, but also the drug repurposing, because now we know more about the pathophysiology of these disorders.
And being also the field so huge, you can find some type of neutropenias with some target drugs, as Elena mentioned before, dapagliflozin, empagliflozin, or mavorixafor. And luckily, we are involved in some clinical trials using at least one of these drugs.
The gene editing field has come a long way, and we have seen now FDA approval of the CRISPR gene editing to reactivate the fetal hemoglobin and beta thalassemia. So it's, as you said, some of the safety concerns of the past in terms of mutagenesis and leukemia, probably, you know, from 20 years ago, have probably passed now. And so that it's the safety and risk. And also it's going to be accessibility again, I suspect, because with all gene editing, there will be a cost associated with that, and we can't make it prohibitive for if it's curative. You know, what cost do you put on such therapies? If your long-term G-CSF infusions is one cost, let alone the curative. So that balance and that framework will obviously have to be assessed, as you mentioned. So it's exciting times, I can imagine. And I found that quite compelling that you mentioned that.
Even because the very long story of the severe congenital neutropenia is not really known. We don't know really what is the median life of patient affected. And probably this would change also the approach by knowing something more on this.
So, you know, to summarize and to bring this amazing conversation to an end about the guidelines, you've written this now. It's highlighted the fact that more research needs to happen in the neutropenia field, both at the clinical trial stage and understanding the molecular genetics to find new targets and drug repurposing, with a view that perhaps even curative with gene therapy if that comes about, and it's probably not if, but when that occurs. You know, is there a message that you'd like to have as the take home to clinicians and patients and even other researchers from this guidelines that you come out and go, okay, here's the main message that we think is also important, other than the guidelines?
What I would say is that, neutropenia is not one disease. It is a spectrum of diseases. Now we know many things, but about the pathogenesis and the pathophysiology of these diseases, and these links to new treatment approaches. Until the new treatment come, we have these guidelines that they are available to everybody, to clinicians, to policymakers, because they are consensus-based guidelines for all kinds of neutropenias. So these are the first time produced guidelines for everybody. And of course, we have to work hard and to collaborate more. And this is the important message, how many beautiful things comes out from a nice collaboration. So we continue to collaborate in order to continue the research. And also we have to have more evidence-based guidelines, because this is a need. So we need collaboration, we need data, and we need well-designed a prospective or randomized clinical trials.
My hope is that first of all, the utility is clinical, but another hope is that it could be the basis for some project to understand something more on neutropenia. There are a lot of fields that deserve some studies, for example, neutropenia in some autoimmune disorders, in celiac diseases, and related to some drugs that are used from the rheumatology. The overlap between the hematology and the rheumatology is a fascinating topic. So starting from what we face every day, we would like that something in the future will be built.
That's been fantastic. And I really hope that the listeners can take the time to find this paper and also go back to the first guidelines paper, because they do certainly shine a very bright spotlight on the field. And not only the amazing guidelines, like I mentioned, I found the paper extremely accessible, very well written. And I'd like to congratulate you both and the entire team, which was, as you said, an amazing collaboration between a lot of experts across the world to bring this to everyone, to improve the health of our patients, which is at the end of the day what's most important. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to all our listeners for joining us, and catch us next time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hemisphere Podcast. All of Hemisphere's content is open access and can be found at www.hemispherejournal.com. We hope you will join us for future podcast episodes.